Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us at, I guess, our first virtual panel discussion about VC Fire Talk, site Fire Talk. We have a little bit about the format. Everybody that is not presenting and not speaking as of the panelists, if you guys could turn off the video, that would be great in order to make sure our bandwidth holds up. Then I'm going to now introduce our sponsors and also our panelists. Our sponsors are Andrew from SVB. Andrew, do you want to say a little bit about you guys?
Sure. Hello, everybody. I see some familiar faces and some hopefully new friends as well. I help lead our startup banking group here in New York City at SVB. We work with all pre-Series A companies here in New York. As we all know, it's a very busy time, especially busy time for us. I predict this will be the busiest week in SVB's history. We're launching our PPP application this evening, so it's kind of all hands on deck on this end. But yeah, we're doing a variety of things to support early stage startups during this time, including webinars like this, trying to get all the stimulus stuff up to speed for our clients. So it's nice to meet you all, and feel free to get in touch after the call if there's anything we can be helpful on. Ruben, thank you for having us, and thanks to our speakers as well for sharing your wisdom today. We appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. Ian from Fenwick and West, as well as one of our sponsors.
Great. Thanks, Ruben. And thanks, Andrew. Great to team up with Berkland and SVB on this. So I'm a startup and venture focused partner here at Fenwick's New York office. Have been spending the last several weeks, as you might imagine, helping startup companies kind of triage their staffing, triage their sort of cash burn, and figure out how to get through what is a really sort of fast moving crisis that we're all going through. So I think it's really timely that we have, you know, three great panelists on to talk about how they're navigating this this issue from the investor perspective. So, you know, timely, and looking forward to be part of this this conversation.
Thanks, Ian. And then there's me, Ruben Austin. I work with Berkland Associates, and we do outsourced CFO work for startups, or so to say, a one-stop shop for a startup's financial needs. Right now, during this whole pandemic, we've been seeing quite the influx to help young startups to restructure themselves and make sure they survive throughout these times that are so uncertain. And now I'm going to turn it over to our panelist, Kunal. Thank you for making it here, and thank you for helping us putting this together. Why don't you just introduce yourself and maybe give us a couple of words?
Yeah, for sure. No, I appreciate you guys all putting this together. I know this is a new format. So far, so good. I work with Hearst Ventures. I'm a principal there. Hearst Ventures has been doing it for about 20 plus years now. the first generation of investments were primarily in media. We were doing Series A through C investments for about the first 10 to 12 years of it, with Netscape, SiriusXM, BuzzFeed, Roku, Pandora. The second generation, kind of second iteration of it, has been as Hearst has diversified at the corporate level and gone into more fintech and healthcare, different software businesses, mobility and transportation. They've been buying over and been pretty acquisitive in the last decade or so. Ventures can now invest basically in any area that's of interest to the company. We don't need to be strategically involved or find a strategic sponsor at the corporation, so we operate very much like a traditional venture fund. We'll do $2 to $5 million checks as a first investment, and so on and so forth. So I've been there a couple of years. First started off in mobility and transportation, making a couple of investments there, and then looked at healthcare, looked at just broad enterprise SaaS. Before this, was investing through NYU's Innovation Venture Fund, which is a small seed stage fund. Spent a couple years at a nonprofit called Charity Water here in New York. Started off my career at JP Morgan, and then kind of went through my own startup as well, which was a seed stage startup for 2 years as well. Worked with Jake and Wendy and a couple of other people on the call on a recent book that I published, which I know Ruben, you're helping to get out there. It's called Finding Genius. So happy to talk about that too. But that's a quick overview.
Awesome. Thank you. Jake, let's turn it over to you. Thank you for making it. You're still muted. I'll help you.
Okay, there we go.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Ruben. So my name is Jake Yormack. I'm one of the founding partners at Story Ventures. It's about a four-year-old firm based in New York. We do all pre-seed and early seed stage investing. So we have an interesting vantage point right now because, some of the founders who are trying to raise for the first time, they don't have payroll and so much overhead. So we're seeing still some founders doing that. And then we have a portfolio now of about 25 to 30 companies. In various stages from seed all the way now through Series C or so. Before I started Story with my partner, Brian, I was a lawyer at Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York. I focused on large mergers and acquisitions and capital markets work. And then I moved to Gunderson, which similar to Fenwick is a firm that focuses exclusively on early stage startup technology companies. And that's what I did there. And then moved to start Story.
Thank you for that, Jake. And lastly, we have Wendy from Northstone.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. I am a principal at Northstone with our New York office. Northstone is a early stage venture capital fund. We have been around since 1996. We were one of the first venture capital funds started in Europe. And since we have grown our AUM and our office presence significantly, we are now based out of London. With offices in Stockholm as well as New York and Oslo and also other folks kind of covering other European geographies such as France and Berlin. We have currently three active funds. The most recent one, which we just closed in November, was a $500 million Series A fund. And we have also an opportunity fund on top of those three early stage funds. At Northstone, we invest in pretty much kind of all general tech sectors. I think the only things we wouldn't invest in are chemicals. I spent a lot of time in Web3 in kind of the emerging ecosystem there, as well as in developer tools and healthcare. And happy to kind of talk about that later. My background is in management consulting. I also started a company in New York called Cohatry. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. We're going to dive right into the questions that we prepared for the panelists. If any of our attendees have any questions, please feel free to put them into the chat to everyone. We will answer hopefully as many as we can at the end of this discussion. So if you guys could tell me a little bit more about sort of like the stages that you guys invest in, what like the typical investment would look like of your startups, and what maybe the average check is as well, just to get it going a little bit to have our participants get a better understanding. Kunal, do you want to start out with that?
Yeah, sure. So we typically will do Series A through C investments. So for Series A, we're looking for, in most cases, we've been doing B2B investments. I think that's going to change now. And typically, we're looking for several kind of enterprise contracts. The companies are making revenue. There's a pretty healthy and robust pipeline where they're continuing to grow and expand their business. That would be across all the industries that we're investing into. We typically, as a first check, would do anywhere from $2 to $5 million, but we have the ability to go up higher because it's all balance sheet capital. We take board seats in all of our investments, so we want to be pretty actively involved. We have offices in the US, in Israel, and in China, and in the UK. So we're investing kind of across Europe, across the globe. And there's about four investment professionals here in New York, five actually. So each of us are making investments, about 2 to 3 per year. Trying to think of what else would be important, but we will continue following on with our investments. So we're investors in VIA, and we actually just invested as part of their Series E, I believe it was. So we're fairly active and kind of continue to support the companies throughout.
Thank you. Jake?
Sure. So we do all pre-seed and early seed. So the way I would, I mean, the terms are a little ambiguous, but the way I would describe it is we're typically first institutional money into the company, either leading or co-leading rounds, all the way maybe through a company raising about $3 million of capital. I'd say once you're raising above three, you're in that more mature seed stage. We invest in what we call data technologies. So my, just as a way of explaining it, my partner, Brian, his background, he had been at a venture capital firm in Detroit that was started by Bill Ford, focused on the future of transportation. So that's anything from self-driving cars to connected vehicles, connected infrastructure, how autonomous systems would impact supply chain and logistics businesses. And what we were seeing at the forefront of autonomy there, in what we call the data stack, is anything from sensors or software systems that are capturing data, whether that's LiDAR, radar, or camera on a car, or a software system, to systems that are organizing, aggregating, and structuring data. So once the data has been captured, how to make that usable. And then ultimately to systems like computer vision in a vehicle or software systems that are leveraging the accessibility of previously inaccessible data. And I mention that just because I think a lot of what we're seeing now is a product of the types of companies in which we invest. We have about 50% of our fund reserved for follow-on investments in the portfolio. And you know, we actually just went through the exercise last week and finalized our new fund model today to really try to anticipate if there will need to be any extra reserves, either protective investments for the existing portfolio, how we think about follow-on investments and the cadence of investments. So, so that's where we sit in the venture capital stack.
Thank you. Wendy.
So we like to kind of focus on Series A, which I think has a floating definition depending on where we are in the tech cycle. I think not too long ago, Series A meant kind of these big, full-blown out $10 million plus dollar rounds. I think we're still sort of defining what that means for this paradigm or kind of the one that we're about to enter into. But our check size is anywhere kind of from 4 or 5 million up to 20 in the initial check, and then we follow on. We also have a seed program, which, you know, is more kind of co-investing, not taking board seats, but only in kind of emerging sectors that we're diving deep into. And so we made a few investments in kind of the Web3 ecosystem as well as in gaming out of the seed fund. And the way we like to think about kind of how we define investment themes is really a cross-section of geography as well as sector-based expertise. And so, for example, one of our first kind of big successes out of two funds ago was Spotify, which is actually, you know, a Swedish company. But from that, we learned a lot about the media ecosystem and content monetization across all different forms, including, you know, text as well as video. And this is probably into some of the stuff that you look at a lot, Kunal, but we followed that theme and invested in several other media companies across the globe, including one in New York called FuboTV. And then, you know, that's sort of an example. Recently, we've been looking less into kind of those types of content sectors and more into kind of deeper industry sectors such as health. And that certainly has different definitions across the globe as well, because the European healthcare system works quite differently than the US one does, for example. That's kind of how we're thinking about, or this is maybe even a bit outdated because this is kind of how we thought about an investment approach just a few months ago. And I'm sure a lot of folks are starting to redefine what it means now. And I think that's probably something you'll want us to talk about going into this panel.
Exactly. So that sort of leads to my follow-up question and how COVID-19 will impact your investment strategy. If you could go a little bit more into that would be great, or how you think it will unfold for your investment strategy.
I mean, I think for us at the Series A through C, it is still very early to tell. And that's just, I know it's probably not a helpful answer to a lot of the founders in the call where there's so much uncertainty in what they're trying to do with their companies. But I think that certainty is going to start coming in the next few months. I think everybody around the entire economy, whatever industry they're operating in, is waiting to see when the snapback actually happens. But just on a week by week basis, what's been going on at the later stage, at least, is we've been trying to support the companies that we've already invested in and going through, which I guess, which is where SVB, Berkeley, Fenwick also come in, which is looking at their balance sheets and looking at kind of financial statements just to see how long can they last? What does their pipeline look like going forward? Where is it softening up in their businesses and what we can do to help support them, which is there's some stuff that VCs can do in terms of playing in the corners and trying to figure that out. But a lot of it is more operational. In terms of new areas for where we're investing, I mean, I think we've seen a lot of deals that we were in the final stages with, not taking to investment committee yet, but actually deep in diligence with, where you've seen, if we weren't going to be the lead investor, you've seen the lead investor drop off. And I think that's also just for a number of reasons, whether they just believe that the valuation is too high. Now that pipeline's starting to drop, they just believe that industry is going to struggle going forward. So it's hard for me to right now. I have areas that I'm interested in as a result of everything that's gone on that I want to start doing more research into, which I can touch on a little bit further later on in the call if that's helpful. But it's too early for me to right now say, okay, for the next year, this is really where I believe we can just start investing all of our capital, because I don't know if we even know if we've hit bottom yet. I think the VC markets move very differently to the public markets. But you're seeing, I think, more funds just supporting their current portfolios right now, where I think there's opportunity for, at the later stages, for venture capital funds like Hearst to play in companies that need to be supported that we might have missed out on earlier because we weren't competitive enough. So now they need more cash, so Hearst can try to come in and say, okay, we'll back you in this next round. So I think that's sort of how we're thinking about it, is supporting current portfolio companies and looking to where we can start to make more investments going forward in a more conservative sense too.
Yeah, so I guess jumping in. So I think the biggest thing that Kunal said is definitely true pretty much across the market, which is Series A funds and beyond are more focused on managing the portfolio right now than anything else. And I've spoken with partners at a lot of funds, and pretty much it's like a no investment zone right now. If firms are deep in diligence, they might finish the process. We had a Series A close yesterday, actually. The term sheet had been given and signed before all of this happened. So, you know, in our experience so far, firms are standing by their word, although I'm sure there are plenty that are not. But I would say it's like almost, it is going to probably be as hard as it ever will be to raise a Series A, Series B, or beyond right now. So what we're spending a little more time talking to founders in our portfolio about is, you know, how to think about a world in which, if they were targeting a fundraise in May or June, how we can delay that until September and what we need to do that. It definitely depends on the kind of companies. You know, in our portfolio, this is more luck than anything else, but I would say, you know, interestingly, more companies are having their best month ever in our portfolio than companies are doing badly, which is a product of, we invest in all like digital first software companies. And of our last six investments, five were in healthcare, which is not because we only do healthcare. It's just because healthcare is so broken and there's been a wave of healthcare entrepreneurship. So even in our portfolio, which I'd actually say is doing well and weathering this as well as possible, we're still completely recalibrating on when we'll be able to fundraise. And that is less a product of the seed firms, more a product of the Series A and beyond firms. And the last thing I'd say is, if you're an early stage founder pitching pre-seed or seed firms, the larger the portfolio that they already have, the harder it's going to be to get their attention. So for us, we have about, like I said earlier, 25 portfolio companies. And because our portfolio is not being that hard hit by this, we actually do have the bandwidth. We are taking meetings. We are considering new investments. My friends that run VCs that have been around for 5+ years, maybe 10 years, they are, you know, maybe bringing a tenth of the normal deals to the partners that they usually do.
So I guess as a potentially later stage investor than both of y'all, or actually, I guess, Kunal, you and I are on pretty similar stages. We've definitely seen also entrepreneurs be more careful about the timing of the raise. So if they can kind of avoid it on from a cash perspective, from going out and accelerating kind of on a raise now, they do. But for us, to echo everyone else, you know, the last 3 weeks really has been, you know, spent on just kind of providing as much bandwidth as we can to help our current portfolio companies. And I think just this week, we're starting to be able to free up kind of more mind space to be a little bit more open-ended about themes that we want to explore. I think the difficult thing about this phase is there's a lot of indecision happening because people are questioning pretty basic assumptions going forward. So for example, if your CAC to LTV was a certain thing before, we need to even question if sort of that ratio exists anymore. And so I think what makes kind of this also an area of opportunity is for companies, or timing wise, for companies that do have to build kind of these basic assumptions from scratch to be able to prove them with sort of the rest of the groups that have already been kind of built on this set of basic assumptions. And so that's kind of like really kind of organic bottoms up adoption, companies that rely on sort of developer evangelism and bottoms up kind of consumer reach. We think that might be an area of focus for us. Though I think to echo everyone else, it is a bit too soon to tell on kind of how the larger deals will shake out in terms of valuation and what people are expecting to see de-risked. We are very actively still processing pipeline. I think that's partially just as a function of us having recently closed this fund. And we've been pretty slow on the investment pace since closing. But I think, you know, because of that, the pace hasn't changed too much.
I think also just to build on that, what's super interesting right now is that it's all evolving very quickly. So it's not like when this all happened, we're like, let's sit on our hands for the next 2 or 3 months after we supported our companies. We're having these meetings a couple of times a week and trying to figure out, okay, if we were to invest, what does it look like if we've never met the founder in person? And is that something that we're willing to do? And how, if so, when Hearst makes an investment, we have to get our entire committee together, which is the heads of different Hearst businesses and the CEO of Hearst. And I think we're starting to see there's more comfort in terms of making big decisions if we have to do it over Zoom. And once we've supported our portfolio company and figured out, okay, these are the blind spots, this is where we need to cover, and this is how we can be helpful, at some point it starts to become more about just the entrepreneur and them operating, and us now starting to look towards the next phase of where do we invest. So we're starting to go into that phase more, is that this looks like the foreseeable future we'll be working remote for at least the next month or 2 months. And I think this is also something that back in 2008 and 2009, it's very different times in terms of like crisis and uncertainty and people not going to work. But this is where I think we, as a fund, I think a lot of funds actually made more investments because valuations started to come down to more reasonable levels too. So it's not saying that we're trying to, I think it's very crass to say that this is working an advantage, but it's also just starting to make some things a little more sense. So there's some founders who were building businesses that were raising at valuations that just didn't make sense. They weren't reasonable. But now the companies that are kind of managing the cash the right way and building good businesses and are sustainable, they're going to continue to get funded. So like Jake was just saying, the 6 healthcare companies, if any of those were raising currently, and Jake's always showed us really good deals. So if he were to show us one of those and it was like, okay, Hearst wants to do that because we have a big health division. So they're not going to say, we're not going to turn away from a $3 to $5 million investment just because of what's going on macroeconomically. We've got a 10-year horizon on these investments. So if it makes sense, then we'll continue to do it despite what's going on. So that's some of the promising side of things for founders too, they're raising right now.
Got it. What do you guys think are the biggest challenges that a startup faces right now?
Well, I'll just jump in quickly, but I think it depends on the industry so much. So there is just like a huge portion of our economy that has been shut down. And there are companies that are in dire straits, and it's no fault of their own that they're in that position. And there's almost nothing that can be done about it. And it's just up to the existing inside investors to support the company. And there's really just like very little to be done in those industries. Just, I mean, I know plenty of companies, and you know, we're lucky again, so this is not in our portfolio, but plenty of our companies that have downsized by 75%+ headcount. And it is just because the industries are like, it's a zero revenue time period for certain industries. I think in our portfolio, it's evaluating every line item and thinking through how tight we can make the budget. It's trying to balance cuts with not cutting into the bone, which is a balance. There's no easy way to do it. It's negotiating software bills with vendors. Ruben, I'm sure you know you've been helpful in advising a lot of your clients to do that. And we're seeing pretty much across the board, software vendors and other vendors are saying yes to either decreases in what is owed or to extensions for payment purposes. You know, I'm sure everyone on this call has been following the SBA loan stimulus program. So there's some of that as well. And then, you know, there are sort of, I think the last thing is really to think through fundraising timelines and what milestones will be needed. And to, you know, Kunal and to Wendy's point, there's a lot of uncertainty right now, but working with your investors to actually understand when the fundraising environment will open up a bit more and what milestones will be needed is helpful.
I think just to build on that too, I mean, Jake just said everything that matters, but the other thing that was interesting is that the companies that we were looking at, some of them were just discretionary. And that's kind of subjective, but we were looking at a corporate education startup that I really liked, was very excited about. But now the question is when companies are starting to pull back on their budgets and saving cash in order to just manage their core operations, does corporate learning just go away as a sector? Does it start to shrink? And that's a very kind of short-minded approach to it, short-term approach to it, but is that something that actually has to be factored into the valuation? So some companies that were discretionary, that were in travel and leisure, that were in, well, I think gaming is blowing up right now, but in education, in kind of retail in different spaces, are there still opportunities there? Because we're just seeing everything flipped on its head. So like Blue Apron was about to go under, and now all of a sudden they've blown back up. And industries that were going away are now that were under pressure, like Zoom, I know there was a lot of pressure on them just in the public markets, and now all of a sudden they've blown back up. So I think it's just a really interesting time where everything's flipped over.
Are there like certain technical things that are you guys currently doing in the boardrooms with your startups? I mean, Jake already said that you're trying to negotiate vendor agreements, right? Is there anything else that you on the technical side are renegotiating or trying to like smooth out on the ops side?
We're looking quite a bit at pipeline and just seeing where that would be soft in terms of like where they were in stages of actually selling an agreement, what they can actually close now based off of what their contracts were in those stages of discussion. We're hoping to get more of those closed. And then there's cash management, which I guess you'd probably be more qualified to talk about than us. But for me, I'm really looking at kind of all pipeline conversations with our companies.
For us, I think there's, you know, for the really early stage kind of pre-revenue companies, some of them can actually afford to be a bit more aggressive, I think, with their go-to-market. And we have conversations around how to do that efficiently. Because now, as we saw sort of with the last recession, there tends to be a shift in people's preferences for kind of decentralizing decision-making on B2B software purchases further down the business unit and trying cheaper alternatives over kind of their existing top-down enterprise relationships. And so that actually kind of spurred the adoption of cloud during the last sort of downturn. And so we're actually, you know, kind of encouraging the companies that have those types of sales models to try to capitalize on this and anticipate kind of this attitude shift. But on the other side, we're also, one of our most recent investments also is in healthcare. It's a mental health company called Spring Health here in New York. They're seeing a ton of growth. And if this is kind of to answer your question about one of the other challenges that startups are probably facing right now, a lot of our portfolio companies are reaching out, asking about kind of mental health solutions that they can provide. And these, you know, these companies probably had these conversations before, but it feels like it's being accelerated. And so for certain companies, there might be the chance to kind of take advantage of that momentum and potentially raise more capital, though I don't know if that's sort of, you know, a rule that any companies can kind of go by just because they're seeing a blip in sales.
Yeah, I would just conclude with, I think what you're hearing from Kunal and from Wendy and from me is that it depends on the kind of company, and there's not really a generalizable answer to the question. The one generalizable thing I'd say is that the more money a company is burning, the harder it is right now. It's not a good time to be a company that was relying on really aggressive growth milestones or relying on future fundraising. So that's partly, I think, why our portfolio, which is a 3.5-year-old fund investing a pre-seed and early seed, is also a little more insulated from what's happening, is that the less money a company is spending, the easier it is to be nimble or to make it an extra 3 or 4 months and maybe slow down the hiring process. And the other thing I would say is that I do think, at least in our portfolio, what happened with WeWork and then with Uber and Lyft going public and struggling in the public markets resonated with them, in, let's say, January, February, and a lot of CEOs and CFOs recognized that it was important to think carefully about unit economics and to tighten belts about 2 or 3 months ago. So for some of those companies, there's not as much of a comeuppance right now because they actually had prepared in advance. But as a general rule, the later stage of the company, probably the more brutal this is.
Have you guys seen a change in deal flow so far? Like pre-COVID-19 to what is happening right now? Has there been anything, or is it too early to tell?
For me, it's been too early to tell. And I'm also looking at the question that was just asked in the chat about the percentage drops in valuation. I think that's also, for me, it's been too early to tell. It's been 2 or 3 weeks. But I know that's been happening across the board with the drops in valuation. Actually, I'm trying to figure out how to drop a graph in here. So maybe while Jake and Wendy are answering, I'll try to screenshot it in. But PitchBook just released a report on kind of net valuations, how those have been dropping. But if you just look at it across the board, I think from 2012 onward, valuations have been going up. So whether they're dropping in a way that's just unsubstantiated or it actually was necessary regardless of COVID, I think that's also a question that we should be asking too. But I'll try to share that if I can.
I guess I'll jump in. So for deal flow, it's definitely slowed down. And I think for us at the pre-seed, part of it is that, you know, if you think about your runway or your burn rate, once you're operating a business and you have payroll and overhead, when you need to fundraise, you need to fundraise. And there are no ifs, ands, or buts about that. You need to pay your employees. You need to pay your rent. For us, a lot of the founders, their runway or their burn rate is just from their savings account, really. And they can go an extra month or two. Typically, if they're starting a company, they can go an extra month or two without fundraising and beginning to pay themselves salaries. So we're definitely seeing a bunch of founders fundraising. I think most of them had started the process before this started, even if they'd started it by a week or two. And my bet is that we're probably, I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I bet that about 50% of founders raising initial capital are waiting and are going to wait an additional month or so before they start the process at the pre-seed. But for seed and Series A companies and beyond, when you need to raise, you need to raise. And that's where there's a big problem, because a lot of, you know, for Hearst and for Northstone and for many others, even though they're looking at new deals, they are understandably preoccupied with supporting the existing portfolio. And so it's a lot harder, and I hope that the founders are working with VCs that believe in them, believe in the business, and are willing to sort of give them a few extra months of runway. And from a valuation standpoint, we've done 2 follow-ons sort of like this week. We haven't led any new deals in the last 4 weeks, but my bet is that there will be a definite valuation drop at pre-seed. We were pretty disciplined to begin with, so it might not be that impactful for us, but I think that it will be like a 10, 20, even 30% drop, mainly because founders just want the money. They're like, if we can get the money, even if the terms aren't great, there's no way they're going to go to the market to try and shop a term sheet and risk losing the investment. So we haven't actually given a term sheet for a new pre-seed deal, but that would be my guess.
At the later stages too, I think you might also see valuations stay same or drop a little bit, but there might be a lot more structure in the deal too. So we saw one term sheet get issued where the liquidation preferences were fairly high and they had a lot of other structure there that wasn't typical kind of for the market that we have been seeing for a company like that. So
and Kunal and I do a deal, you know, are invested in a deal together that did a hybrid convertible and equity investment as well. So you're beginning to see at the later stage a mix of mix of investment structures that are perfectly normal. They had been reserved more frequently for slightly later stage companies, and now you've got PE funds that are beginning to dip their toes in, saying, you know, I see a really great business, and I can, I can do a $10 to $50 million credit facility with very strong warrant coverage, for example.
That's really interesting to hear that you guys are seeing that in the market. I guess there's a ton of dry powder in PE right now, and it's interesting to hear they're going into kind of earlier stage venture. From a valuation perspective, I think we've started to see declines even kind of around the WeWork era, and it was almost a precursor to this. And I still think it's too soon to kind of land on where we've gotten from a percentage perspective. But we haven't done a kind of a big Series A deal since Q4. So it's not too many data points from our perspective, but we've done a number of kind of earlier stage seed deals, and I don't think those have been too affected from valuation perspective. I'm just trying to see here the questions. How does COVID-19 affect valuation when you're locked into valuation with an initial lead investor? I'm assuming that means from a prior round, like you did a round at a valuation, maybe that was a bit high, and then kind of how do you think things are going to play out now? Let me know if I'm interpreting that wrong, but I've heard on Twitter that there are folks that are going in aggressively with kind of these crammed down valuations for companies that are doing really well and kind of squeezing the pref stack. I don't know if that's myth or if that's already happening, but it'd be interesting to kind of get your perspectives on that if you've heard anything.
I haven't seen that happen yet either, in terms of cramming people down, but I can imagine it's going to start coming, especially with like what Jake was saying, and Wendy was saying, where cash is an issue. But the ones that have enough cash and have been pretty diligent with how they're spending, we've had two or three companies that are just deferred raising that I was excited about investing in, and we were pretty close to, and they both have said, we're just going to wait because we don't think we can get the terms right now that we need. And they're waiting 3 to 6 months. I imagine at the end of this year, if this continues, then they're going to say, okay, you know what, we'll accept whatever terms we can, just because we need to try to chase down pipeline and keep growing. And in order to kind of hit what Wendy was just talking about, hit that valuation if their internal, their last lead had priced at a pretty high point. So that's sort of what we're seeing, but we haven't seen any of those crammed down yet.
Is venture debt or SBA loans, do you guys think it will make a big difference in what's happening to like help a company survive, especially when they're cash strapped?
We actually just spoke with a company right before this that does qualify for the SBA loans based off the affiliates and some of the other regulation that I know Fenwick and SVB and everybody's been going through and helping everybody else understand. They qualify for it, and that helps. I mean, it's basically a grant at this point that they don't need to pay back. And I think there was one term in there which was making founders liable for it, even if the company failed in order to pay that back. That's also been removed now, where now it's on the company and it's based off of the company that's been incorporated. So then there's still more clarity coming out around it, but many of our companies don't qualify based off the original docs that came out. But there are some that do, and for them, it's going to be a whole world of difference because now they don't need to go out to the venture market to raise right now.
The one thing I'd say though, because I think every single one of our portfolio companies will be eligible. The only thing being the affiliation rule, but it sounds like that will get resolved in favor of venture-backed startups, although I guess it's TBD. It is about a month of runway. So, you know, you multiply payroll times 2.5 capped at 100K per employee and anything else you can add in. And it ends up being, I think, for the portfolio companies that have submitted the applications already, just under 1 month of runway. So that's a huge deal. A month right now is actually a huge deal, but it's a month. So I don't think this is going to be like a game changer for pretty much any company in our portfolio, but it's only good.
Thank you. Yeah. Is there any particular, sectors that you guys have your eyes on now, given the current climate? or is there something like that you wouldn't have invested in 3 months ago? I mean, we spoke about healthcare a little bit. Is that something you guys are now focusing on more, or software, or are you still very much with the same investment strategy?
Our investment strategy hasn't changed. It's kind of what I was alluding to earlier in the call. Our investment strategy hasn't changed too much in terms of the focus areas that we've had, because we are still taking a longer term approach, but there are new areas that are becoming more interesting to us and some that are becoming less interesting. So just one example, I was talking about corporate learning and education before, and that might be something that maybe we get a bit more nervous about or wary about, as our corporate budget's going to be going into corporate learning and corporate development, employee wellness, and those areas that are a bit more discretionary. But at the same time, you've seen how when remote education needs to take place, how it falls apart in the K-12 or kind of at the university level or specialized skills. So are there software services that help to improve that? And we were looking at another travel company that was doing travel data. That is something that we probably won't look at in the near future. As airlines also, their margins get more compressed. Digital health will continue to be interesting, but the assumption is that a lot of the things that need to be funded already have been funded. Does this short-term change the appetite for more clinical trial type companies or testing? But every VC is going to be looking at those, and they're all going to be marking those up. So I don't think it makes sense to go and flood and everybody look at those same directions now just out of excitement, because we probably, to be frank, even if we can compete, the valuation will just be so high that it doesn't even make sense for us to do it. So I think we're kind of sticking core to where our investment strategy was, so we keep getting into the deals that made sense to us, that we know well, as opposed to just flocking to a new area.
Yeah, so for us, you know, our thesis, which is all around data technologies, is a horizontal thesis. You can apply it to any vertical. In reality, the four verticals we spent the most time in are transportation, logistics, healthcare, and finance. And I think that there will probably be some very interesting innovation in healthcare for sure. I bet in education, like Kunal said, I'm sure as well in logistics and supply chain technologies, and even to an extent in transportation and finance is very innovative always. I don't think this will change the way we think about investing from a principled standpoint. You know, we had looked at a lot of companies touching the travel space, touching the hospitality industry, you know, companies that touch the physical world. And we had never quite gotten there, even though we'd very seriously considered a lot of those investments. One of the reasons being that a lot of those industries are very low margin industries. And we never loved the idea of selling software to low margin buyers, because if something happens, that's not ideal. Now, this something is not what we anticipated, but it's something we thought about a lot. I think it gives us extra reason to really make sure we understand the implications on a business model of touching the physical world. More ways, I think of a company like One Medical, for example, versus a pure telemedicine company. So One Medical has physical locations. And what is the overhead and the burden of a company to have that as opposed to a pure software company? And one of the reasons I think we've been pretty insulated from this is we've ended up avoiding a lot of those investments, even though some of those companies can be great companies. So I don't think there will be too much of a shift, although there will be a lot of opportunity for sure.
Yeah, we're actually seeing pretty explosive growth in some of our ed tech companies, because I think ed tech was an area that had a lot of holes to both of your points, but now they're becoming kind of surface because people are trying to homeschool and these communication tools are just breaking down all over the place. So we definitely think that there's kind of opportunity there just from the perspective of folks being more cognizant of the problem and putting capital and work and time into it. We also, you know, we think that this is an idea I'm working on, but it probably sounds like a lagging indicator, though. Who knows? This idea of kind of debundling Zoom, so to speak. I think, you know, we have seen kind of the rise of these video conferencing startups that have different purposes than just kind of general one-on-one. We're investors in a conferencing company, a video conferencing company called Hopin. They do virtual events. This was pre-COVID. And so my partner who led that was very kind of forward thinking when or very, very lucky, or you know, that this kind of trend hit the right way for that company. But we do think that video is something that is going to be, you know, here for the long term. And this is anything just kind of an acceleration of the adoption curve there. But of course, everyone kind of also has the same thesis to Kunal's point. So we'll see kind of where valuations and these types of kind of hype net out. But I think also what's incredibly interesting to us, and this I spoke a little bit about earlier, is kind of these bottoms-up developer-driven tools. We do see a lot of architectural changes in the development world, abstracting away a lot of the complexities of configuring servers and configuring different backends and CMS, and you know, this, not to get too kind of technical into that world, but we think that this is the time a lot of this bottoms-up adoption will be really, really interesting, and developers can build a community without a physical presence. And so a lot of that virtual kind of community building is already happening online, will only accelerate kind of in this time period. And so we're hopeful that some of those get kind of real business adoption, and we're looking deeply into that as well.
It is also just super interesting to think about like what on the consumer side too. I mean, I think since we had that focus on B2B for so long, and it just seemed like the more kind of conservative, safer bet to make on the enterprise side. But on the consumer side, there's millions of people sitting at home now, and kind of what are they engaging with in this new lifestyle? I think that creates a really interesting opportunity for some entrepreneurs too, who are building something that will keep people busy at home, or this new lifestyle if they're traveling and they feel unsafe, or personal development. I know Masterclass now is doing well, and Coursera saw millions of downloads. And so just changing a lot in terms of on the consumer side, how do we spend our time if this is to continue? But even if it is to continue, what kind of PTSD do people have from it? That leads to new opportunities in a way that keeps people safe and more just personally engaged if they're on their own for longer. So it's also just an interesting thing to creatively think about on what founders are working to. So we're looking for that.
Yeah. And I would jump in with one other, just like a anecdotal company, because I agree, you know, Wendy, with everything you just said in terms of, one, an acceleration of the adoption of more like remote communication tools, whether it's video or, you know, a company like Slack, to how this impacts consumer in like a digital first way. And, you know, we invested in a company, for example, that pairs people with nutritionists, and you have a nutritionist, you know, a text away in your pocket, and they're seeing the spike in growth. And, you know, it's like built for something like this. But the company that is slightly differently that I was going to talk about, so we invested in a company called Inspirin. What they do is they put sensors above hospital beds in hospital rooms, and they use computer vision. And the use case mainly was, one, monitoring patient falls. So if a patient falls out of bed right now, a hospital might not know about it until a nurse comes by and sees that patient, or if the patient's able to hit a call bell. Inspirin's sensory technology automatically recognizes that and sends a push notification to a nurse. If a patient hasn't moved in bed in an hour or so, patients tend to develop bed sores. So Inspirin's computer vision technology sees that and again notifies nurses. It can track nurses coming in and out of hospital rooms. Interestingly, they built thermal capabilities into their sensors. And if you've read anything about what's happening in China or elsewhere, one of the reasons they've been able to keep this COVID breakout somewhat under control after the initial wave is because they're using thermal sensors to be able to see when people walk in and out of rooms or in and out of buildings, if they have heightened temperatures and therefore potentially have fevers. And so having the real estate on the wall in a hospital, they have to now like build out slightly more robust software around the thermal sensors to make them work the way they want them to work. But you can start to see the beginnings of how real world sensory technologies can you know, be used to actually help in a very quickly changing world where maybe I'm a little nervous about privacy stuff, but maybe this is what's needed and maybe this is the direction we're going. Anyway, I just share that because it's something people might not be thinking about, but hopefully it gives a little insight into some of the ways that we're seeing very, very early quick change on the front lines from a data standpoint.
So I know you guys were all part of Kunal's book, Finding Genius. You guys were co-contributors. Can you guys tell me, like, as the title says, Finding Genius, I'm sure you're still trying to find genius in the current markets. Can you guys tell us a little bit more about the book? Because I'm sure a lot of people also signed up for the book and are interested to find out a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, I can start, but Jake and Wendy were big parts of it. But it's about 2.5 years in the making, and it was interviews with a lot of the top VCs who first backed some of the companies that were mentioned today already, Spotify, Airbnb, Pinterest, Tesla, to see if there's any patterns between all of them. And I think in this current market, I guess some of the qualities of genius that I wrote down in the book were based off of interviews with Fred Wilson, and then used those as a juxtaposition against what every other VC said. And one of the big things that they said was a propensity to deal with uncertainty, and being able to actually go through that and deal with that for a longer period of time. And I guess Jake and Wendy, since they're investing in the seed, also see that quite often. But when I was trying to start my company, for example, I had no kind of tolerance for uncertainty. So I pulled the escape cord after 1.5 years. So I'm not one of the geniuses that you would back during a time like this. But I think the ones that actually make it through this are the ones that are able to deal and see the clarity of going through it. But the book is structured with the first kind of 8 to 10 chapters written by me based off these interviews, and then interviews with Jake and kind of on the pre-seed side, raising a venture fund, what that process looked like, how he's competing against for the deals, which I'm sure you can talk to. And then Wendy wrote a chapter on blockchain, who's kind of contributed her time there. So.
Yeah, the book is great. I highly recommend it. Notwithstanding my contributions to it, it's really excellent. My partner, Brian, at Story, he wrote a chapter on autonomy and transportation, which is also really good. Kunal and I have spoken about this a lot. One of the things that I feel, and this might be because of my background as a lawyer at firms like Cravath and Gunderson, you know, we're certainly looking for some stroke of genius to anticipate what the future is going to look like. But I can say for us in particular, Story, we're looking more than anything for sort of like an expectation of greatness in oneself, tremendous detail orientation, and tremendous analytical rigor in everything that a founder does. And there are I think if I were sort of advising an entrepreneur, it would be to understand that there probably are two different types of VCs. There are the VCs that really are looking for a vision of how the world is going to change, and they invest behind the excitement from a vision. And then there are funds that I would describe us more as, even though we certainly pay attention to the vision and everything we do is fairly frontier oriented, but we're really looking for the rigor of the human being, the ability to not miss anything, the ability to inspire people who are like-minded to do that as well. So I think the book's great and you'll get a bunch of different perspectives, but just giving ours, you know, we care more about the analytical rigor, attention to detail, and perseverance and expectation of excellence than I think I would say we do about genius. I think Wendy might be permanently muted. She might need help.
There we go.
There we go. Thanks.
Unmuted again.
yeah, I think, you know, just to echo that, I mean, definitely that is what we look for in a founder. It's you know, to Kunal's earlier kind of metaphor, it's someone that can kind of navigate through this uncertainty, but also create the reality that they think the world should live in. And so it is maybe easier for them to navigate the uncertainty because they think it should be kind of this certain way anyways. But I think with the additional kind of filter on top of that at Series A, we're really excited, you know, we're really excited to back founders that kind of have this persona, but also fit into kind of the market evolution. And I think back to the book, this is what I think it gives a really great view of for someone who's not as kind of familiar to venture and how kind of tech investment decisions are made. What is kind of the context you're working with? What is sort of the pattern, collective pattern recognition that these investors have sort of garnered within their firms and across firms? You know, the chapter on Web3 is probably, you know, the one of the kind of more forward-looking, I would say, and if not futuristic, visions of kind of how the web could be. We certainly don't invest into kind of predicting the future either, but the idea kind of for us behind thesis development is we're constantly iterating against these hypotheses, I would say, rather than visions, and then seeing kind of if any of those hypotheses prove true. And I think that's also a common thread that I found was really interesting in the book. It's more about kind of bottoms up data gathering, but also kind of projecting this top down vision and hypothesis, and being able to kind of marry the two.
Thank you. We actually received two questions that I would like to extend to you guys. And then after that, we can tell everybody how they can get in touch with you guys and wrap it all up. So the questions was, what advice would folks have for a pre-revenue company raising a pre-seed round during this time?
Okay, I can take that one. Okay. My advice would be, if you're fundraising, you can reach out to VCs. If you can wait 2 or 3 weeks, that would probably be my suggestion, just because most partners at firms are just incredibly preoccupied right now with the existing portfolio. But it's okay. You can reach out. You can start the process. I would say I mentioned this earlier, the larger the fund, the less attention you're going to get right now, because the larger the portfolio, the more preoccupied the partners probably are with the existing portfolio and how to support those companies. And I would say it makes a lot of sense to the extent you can figure it out, to reach out to VCs that have expressed specific interest in the category you're pursuing. When we pass right now, I'd say 80% of the we pass on a lot of deals because we don't think it's the right fit, but 80% of the passes that maybe we would further explore, and who knows, maybe get to an investment with one or two of them, if it's not something we know a lot about right now, we just don't have the bandwidth to do a full diligence process in a new industry. So I would say if you're pre-revenue raising around, I still think it makes sense to reach out to funds, but I would try and be very targeted in that. And if you can wait 2 or 3 weeks, that's ideal. And then the last thing is that, you know, a lot of pre-revenue, pre-seed companies get funded by angel investors. And I think now is just like a really shitty time to reach out to angel investors. So I almost would just advise waiting another month or more before reaching out to angel investors. You know, we're paid to invest in early stage startup companies, so we're still open for business, even though it's harder now than ever to get money from a pre-seed or any fund. Angel investors are not paid to do this, and I think most of them are preoccupied with the markets.
There was actually a follow-up question to that as well, and what should a young startup do in order to stick out right now to a VC fund?
Have really good growth metrics.
I think so. And definitely that. And then also, if there's like showing the fact that even during the hot times, they were disciplined with how they were managing cash will be huge. Because if it shows that just when cash was easy to come by, they were just spending through it, got to really ridiculous, huge valuations. I know you said early young startups, but I mean, that could even be someone that just raised a pre-seed round or angel funding. Like, how long do they make that money last? What do they do with it? And telling that story in a really succinct way will be helpful to show us that this founder is disciplined, that even in dark times, they can survive and do well. I think just showing that in 2017 and 2019, you've just been burning through as much money as possible and haven't really gotten anywhere probably wouldn't be the best story. So figure out kind of how you tell that story that you're a disciplined entrepreneur. And why you'll be able to outlast this kind of recession if we go into it.
And I'll just add to that, I think back to the basic assumptions, being able to paint a really clear picture of exactly how you're going to prove that the basic assumptions of your business works. So if you're going to spend $20 per customer on Instagram marketing, hopefully not, that's not what you're doing with your first round of capital. But if you do decide to do that, what exactly, you know, you kind of have to break it down from scratch rather than going into kind of your benchmark decks from other gaming companies or whatever, because I think now is the time to be able to question some of those basic assumptions, but also to use them to your advantage.
Yeah, it's not, I would just say last thing. I don't think standing out is really that different than standing out 3 months ago was. it's very hard to stand out to VCs. To get to raise money from North Zone, from Hearst, from Story is very hard. We invest in, I don't know, 1 or 2% of the founders we meet. So it's hard to begin with. It's going to be hard. The scarce thing right now is the attention of VCs, because everyone's preoccupied with the existing portfolio. So the answer would be to be more targeted than normal, to try and find VCs that have expressed interest in what you're doing in the category, because if they haven't or they don't know, you're probably just going to get blown off right now. So I would say probably start fewer conversations than you would have 2 months ago, and just try your best to make them as targeted and specific as possible.
Well, this was awesome. Thank you, guys. One quick note at the end, tell all of our people or participants that are still here how to get in touch with you guys. And then we will turn it to the sponsors as well and how you guys can get in touch with them. And that's it. That concludes it. Thank you. Kunal, maybe?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, everyone. So you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm checking messages there, and then my email is on that also. So happy to talk, whenever.
Yeah, you can reach out. So LinkedIn works, or you can go to our website, storyventures.bc, and you can see the contact info there, or you can see my info on LinkedIn too. And it's Jake Yormack.
I'm not as good on LinkedIn, though. If you tried me there, I might be able to see your message. I'm more active a bit on Twitter. It's at WENX. It's at WEN_XS. But it's also available on our company website, northzone.com.
Thank you. Ian?
Sure. Yeah, you can feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Again, it's Ian Goldstein. Or you can find me on www.fenwick.com. Good luck, everyone out there.
Andrew?
Thanks, everybody, for putting this together. Like Wendy, I'm probably most active on Twitter. So it's A-O-D-O, O-D-D-O, except the O, first O is replaced with a zero. Somebody stole that from me. On Twitter or on LinkedIn, or I drop my email in the chat as well. I'm just aodo@svb.com as well. Thanks, everyone.
Awesome. And for me, LinkedIn is the best, Ruben A. Austin, or you guys can just visit brooklynassociates.com if you guys have any needs when it comes to your financial planning of your startup. Thank you. This concludes it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And stay safe. And as I say, stay sane. I think that's much more important these days, right? Have a good one. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.